He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain.
Hello and welcome to another There Giants podcast with me, your host, Roger Munter. And boy, this is going to be fun. My guest this week, Mike Farron, has done, I guess, just about everything possible to do with baseball and a microphone. From early days at WGN, he's been a show host at MLB Radio for 15 years. He has done major league play-by-play with the Diamondbacks, minor league play-by-play. He's now doing college play-by-play as part of ESPN's coverage. And along the way, he's done a vast array of podcasts, including one I'm going to talk about in a minute that to this day is my very favorite prospect podcast I've ever heard. So, Mike, it is a real privilege and a pleasure to have you on the show. How are you doing this evening?
Well, I'm thrilled to be a part of it, Roger. Thanks so much for asking me to do it and to talk a little Giants. I feel like I never get to talk enough Giants. I love talking about this team and I really enjoy I probably enjoy, because I'm not a Giants fan, watching the way their seasons develop more than Giants fans do, because even in the good seasons, it feels like torture is the the appropriate word.
There are a portion of Giants fans who never enjoy watching the way their seasons develop, including the current one. I will say that. I see baseball in the background. How much baseball would you say you consume of an evening?
Too much. I'm in Arizona, right? So I'm a West Coaster in the season, so everything gets started at 3 o'clock. I will most nights during the season, if I'm not at the ballpark, I'm locked in for 4 or 5 hours. I try to see as much as possible. The problem with being a generalist is that you see a little bit of everything, I think, if you're doing it right, but not enough to dig in. And so it's nice to get assignments every once in a while where you can really focus and lock in on stuff, like if you're at a game in person. But I consume a lot of baseball, whether it's Major League or Division I. My wife has a far different viewing habits than I do, and I don't think she appreciates mine. So
I have the exact opposite problem, and I suppose my readers do too, because of me. And I'm so deep in watching the Giants system. So I literally, I drive down tomorrow. I drive to Richmond, watch the game. Mm-hmm. While driving home, I'll be listening to at least two of their affiliates sort of concurrently in my drive home. And then, watch on MILB at like 1 a.m. to catch the one I miss. So what you miss is what's going on in the rest of, player development, which right. is one reason why I wanted to have you on here. So I do want to start with this podcast, which I think is really when I first started listening and appreciating you, that you did a decade or so ago, called Fringe Average with Jason Parks. Okay. Who was at the time the lead prospect writer at Baseball Prospectus. I don't know if I'm the only Fringe Average groupie you've ever encountered, but to this day, a lot of how I think about player development does come from some of the conversations I listen to on that podcast. I guess I should stop there. Do people just stop you on the street and ask you about Fringe Average? Because it was a fun show.
Yeah, I think the other podcast that Jason did, Up and In with Kevin Goldstein, is the one that was really the popular one. I feel like we were probably more like hipsters, even though it was the follow-up, in that there are a couple of people that do. And, and I'm grateful for that. Jason is still one of my closest friends. Unfortunately, with the way that life goes for both of us, we very rarely see each other, even though we live about 3 miles apart. But I spend a lot of time with him talking about baseball, and I have over the years. And I think we both come at it from different perspectives. Jason is obviously a scout and has, right. has been a professional scouting director now for the last 6 years, whereas I'm just a broadcaster who likes to be a know-it-all. Just trying to gather as much information as possible was really important. And I think that the thing is that as much as I love and use data. The thing that we really bonded over is that, like, we're obsessed with scouting and player development because it's fun, right? It's more subjective. And when it's more subjective, it means that there's more room for more room for error, both positive and negative, right? So so it was a lot of fun doing it. It was great for the year plus that we were able to do that until he got hired by the Cubs. And you know, I keep joking with him that at some point we should do something again, but I don't think he's ever going to come back to the public realm like that. So he's got a pretty good gig, and he's a really talented evaluator.
So the reason I thought this was sort of a good entree into this discussion is that program was kind of going on, and the one he did with KG before that, right at a fulcrum of kind of major disruption, I think, in player development, in how organizations, in how they hire, which is why a writer from Baseball Prospectus is getting hired into scouting departments, but in how they think, how they use data, how they use technology. And I kind of want to start with you there, a big picture look of, in this time that you've been talking about player development, talking about baseball, what are the major changes you've seen? And maybe along with that, what are the major things that haven't changed in the way people inside the game think about player development?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost that there has been a greater trend towards individualized player development, right? So this is healthy, right? This is a really good positive change. I think there was at times, and you know, this is probably unfair to some degree, but I do think that there were at times one size fits all development plans that based on your handedness or your size or your arm slot or your role on the field defensively, or, you know, your physical characteristics, that there was one plan that was kind of rolled out for everybody. Now, I think, in large part because we have data that can help make it easier for coaches to personalize plans. And I think because players have had more resources to go and seek out individualized player development, that we've seen a shift in that. So I would say that to me is the biggest change. I would say too, that to some degree, like in terms of things that are pretty similar, is that there is a level of old habits die hard still in pushing some of the more advanced changes. I mean, I think that there are things that are happening at the collegiate level, and you've seen some teams address this, right, with a number of kind of smaller school coaches that have been hired over the last, let's say, 5 or 6 years that have been brought into player development roles because they've been working with data more closely. So you've started to see this evolution, but I do think that there is a little bit more of, you know, there is a little bit more resistance, I think, at the professional level than there is at the amateur level in trying something new. And I think part of that is understandable, right? Because by nature, you're going to be more conservative at the professional level on that because the risks associated are greater, right? It's more money invested in players. It's more man hours lost if something goes wrong. There's also a greater degree of player or of coaches and executives' jobs being on the line if stuff doesn't work. And so I think that's where some of it comes from. But I do think that it has been a slow evolution process over the last decade to where we are now. And I think we're just, you know, if we were to use a gas gauge, right, like Letterman used to when he called Joe Louis and asked him how much gas was in his car, right? Like, I think we're probably closer to a quarter of the tank full than we are to all the way full.
So one thing you said in there that made my ears perk up was that players have the ability to go seek out, you know, individualized development for themselves. One horse I tend to beat a lot is that we over assign credit to organizations in development, which has the effect of undermining the volition of players themselves in their own development. Part of this story, obviously, is whether it's swing coaches like you know, Doug Mata, or the place with Driveline, of course, and pitching labs, and that players had a place of their own agency to go and work on their own development, and that, in a way, forces the industry to start looking at things in a different way. You know, how much of this change was outside in as opposed to an evolution within the industry itself?
I think it's always outside in, right? Like, I think we've seen that in, you know, like what you highlighted at the front in, you know, the changes in player development over the last or player or in scouting over the last decade or so, right? We've seen more teams and more people willing to accept outsiders as peers because they valued their opinion because they weren't stuck in the day-to-day grind of just trying to keep a team on the field, which is a lot of what, I mean, think about it in any line of work, right? It's very difficult to innovate in any job when you're focused with 30 tasks that you have to get done on a given day, right? And so I do think that it's been outside in that regard. I think one of the really healthy things has been that teams have become much more willing to allow players to go outside the organization for player development. And I think in some cases, like Seattle, is does a really good job of coordinating with those outside coaches to make sure that the messaging stays the same, either with the club suggesting messaging for a player or with the player's personal coaches suggesting messaging for the club so that they can get the better results out of a player when they need to make adjustments or they need to be reminded of something. So I think that that is part of it. But I think you raise a really good point in here too, in that you know, in the end, this is something like it's one of those things with the benefit of hindsight, we have a greater, like, it makes sense, right? Like, it's all of a sudden, it's like, oh yeah, well, of course it makes sense that you would encourage guys to seek outside help because it's their career and they would take ownership of it. You know, you're not actually trying to undercut somebody. You're just trying to create as many good opportunities for players as possible. And I think that that's something that we are continuing to see shift and improve. I'm sure that there are probably some coaches and organizations that still don't like that players go outside the organization because they feel like they're undercut at times by it. But in the end, it's their career. They're the ones that have to take responsibility from it. And no matter how much we talk about like Cleveland being really good at the pitching plan or the Dodgers developing hitters or all of that, it's still up to the player to make those decisions and to make those improvements.
I think when you talk about individualized development, that's something that every organization talks about, but not every organization does well. Another thing like that is thinking about every single player in your organization as a prospect, as a guy who can come up and help you. That's not always been the case. I think it's more and more the case these days. I remember having a conversation, I think it was with Kyle Haynes a few years ago, where he said, you know, Buster Posey isn't really a player development story. Buster Posey was going to be Buster Posey for whatever organization was smart enough and lucky enough to draft him and get him in. Player development stories are Tyler Fitzgerald, you know, Austin Slater, Logan Webb. It's getting those guys, and everybody has to be on board kind of to get the most, get those development going in the best direction possible. And I think that's even true with like the Clevelands and the Dodgers. There are some times where they're the beneficiaries of circumstances with the quality of kid they have or the player they have. It's hard to tell how good some organizations are at development. I think still to this day.
I totally agree. And I think, and in the end, it comes down to the player, right? The player has to be, you know, you could have, like, how many stories can you think of where a player has made an adjustment? Who is that? I was thinking of Ryan Pressly, right? So Ryan Pressly with the Astros is a great example of this, right? That Pressly gets traded from Minnesota to the Astros. Jesus, going back on like half a dozen years now, right? And at the deadline, they bring him in and they present him with a whole bunch of information and they say, we need you to use your fastball like this and use your breaking ball this way. And we want you to, I think if I remember the story right, a lot of it had to do with his slider usage, right? And Pressly takes off and he's been actually one of the best postseason closers in baseball history. I mean, he's been a tremendous player. He was good with the Twins. You know, he was a Rule 5 pick out of the Red Sox system, and he was good there. And a lot of the conversation after that point when Pressly kind of went off at the end of the year was, well, geez, why didn't the Twins do that? And you listen to the Twins say, and they were like, yeah, we kind of told them the same thing. Sometimes it's how the message is delivered, right, as much as anything. Or it's the timing in a player's career. Like maybe they feel like they really need to listen to it at this moment. Like you're right that there that can be very, very different depending on you know who's delivering the message or what condition the player is in to receive the message. You know, I think it's one of the things why we keep talking about how important failure is at the minor league level, yeah. right? Like, you learn a lot more when we screw stuff up than we do by getting it right. And we just do. And so, like, watching guys struggle, as painful as it is for the player, and as much as I think most coaches and executives in player development would ache for them in those situations, they also realize that often that's the path to breakthrough into success.
Yeah. So not that the Orioles necessarily had a great reputation at the time, but Kevin Gausman, kind of the, you know, high draft choice, high prospect, young hot arm with the Orioles, is maybe going to hear information in a way that is different from Kevin Gausman, who's just been released by two teams in the last 6 months, when he comes to the Giants and they say, maybe stop throwing the slider and bump up the splitter usage significantly.
Well, and I think he's a good example too of some of the changes, right? So, like, I did minor league games in Bowie right about that time that Gausman was drafted. And there was still a feeling in that organization, and they were not alone in this, I'm not trying to blame the Orioles on it, that, like, hey, you got to pound your fastball at the bottom of the zone, right? Like, that's the real key. And there was a guy, I don't know if you remember, he was with the Giants too. He was actually traded, I think, from the it was a Rule 5 maybe to the Giants, got returned. Steve Johnson,
was a Rule 5 that they returned.
Who pitched for the Orioles for a while too. And I covered Steve a fair amount in the minor leagues, and he had one of those 91, 92 mile an hour fastballs that was an invisible at the top of the zone, right? But the feeling was, well, if he throws that at the big league level, it's going to get hit. Steve battled some injuries, but there was a little bit of an adjustment in philosophy that was made, that when Steve got to the big leagues, he had some success because that fastball was unique. The way it played at the top of the zone was unique. And again, this is just kind of the evolution of how you look at players or how they evolve, that I think is a good example of how that changed about the same time that Gausman was coming through the organization. Gausman had some good years with the Orioles. Like, it's not like he was a bad pitcher for them. He was good. They were very careful with him in a way that is almost Paul Skeensian for what the Pirates are doing with Skeens right now, in that they would consistently option him and try and limit his innings. And they were very, very careful because they didn't want him to get hurt, because they knew how special he was. It's just that may have helped to stunt a little bit of his development. But at the same time, he was able to learn some things that probably didn't work for him. You know, he's not a guy that can really throw a breaking ball. He's pretty unique in that he's fastball, changeup, splitter. Like, that's really what works. And he's got this little cutter that, you know, it's not a great pitch, but it gives a little bit different look. But, like, that's the thing with the evolution, I think, that you're talking about in this time frame too, is that players that were perceived one way are now looked at a different way. And that's, you know, that evolution happened, you know, in rolling 10-year periods before that as well, as, you know, we saw more high fastballs in the 80s. And then the idea was pound the bottom of the zone during the steroid era. And then, you lose the East-West as umpires start getting evaluated by, you know, radar technology and some of the precursors and camera technology. And so, like, all those things are evolutions in player development that happen. And some places they take a little bit longer before they take hold in some of those changes, and others it doesn't. And usually you see a change in administration if it goes on long enough.
Well, I do want to talk, dive into Giants baseball and get out of generalism, but I wanted to set this up as sort of the changes that have been taking place over the last decade. And I think about a decade ago, there were a few teams, you know, Cleveland, LA, Tampa Bay, who we know kind of like were at the forefront of some changes going on in player development. And a lot of other organizations have spent the last half decade or so trying to catch up to some of those changes. But so you've been involved, you've worked for the Diamondbacks, you've been a generalist. I kind of want to get the outside perspective on how the Giants player development is generally perceived, has been perceived, maybe, you know, before Farhan Zaidi took over and since then. I feel like when I have conversations with a lot of people in the prospects, it's like they're one of these vanilla teams that they're not hot, they're not cold, they're in the squishy middle where everyone is, and so you don't talk about them that much, and I don't get really good conversations. But what's your perception on kind of how their development has been and has evolved over the last decade?
Well, no, one, I will say this, and just because I miss talking to him, not because I think, you know, like, I don't I have great amount of respect for the player development guys that are running the Giants, but I miss Fred Stanley because Chicken was the best. That guy rules. So having a conversation, he loved players, right? And so, like, talking to him and listening to him gush, I remember going back, this is, gosh, going back forever ago when, like, Pablo Sandoval was in that group at High A, right? With, I think, was like Nickel Noonan and maybe Charlie Culbertson, and I think it was Posey there too, and Angel Villalona, and like, and I
and, he and had, Kyle Haynes actually.
Kyle Haynes was in that group, yeah. And who was the outfield? Darren Ford and Kieschnick, and right, like, so, like, I think squat powerful right-handed hitting outfielder.
Thomas Neal.
That's it. Yeah. I was convinced from talking to Fred Stanley that they were going to have 8 regulars come out of that group because you're like, and like, there was a really good farm system at that point. Right. And you can see what happened to most of those names. Right. So I think what's happened is that I think you're right that like, there's this perception that they're kind of in the squishy middle. And I think when you get organizations that don't have a ton of regulars that are developed from within, whether they be in the rotation or in the lineup, that you kind of either get stuck with that label, whether it's fair or not. You know, the Giants have not been a team that has drafted high very often over the course of the last 15 years. There've been a couple of seasons clearly where they didn't. And, you know, unfortunately when they took number 2 overall, it didn't work out with Joey Bart in San Francisco. But I think that's part of where it is. It's very difficult to do what the Dodgers have done, right? Which is continue to draft at the bottom of the first round and still roll out players that are contributors, right? But even then, like, they haven't had, like, I think the perception of their system is greater than what the production has been of late, in part because they have young pitchers that still haven't established themselves. Mm-hmm. But I think what happens is that the narrative changes as players have success. So you mentioned Logan Webb, right? I'm a big Keaton Wynn fan, right? Big, Kyle big Harrison fan. All of a sudden takes another step forward. Like, that's 3/5 of their rotation that really are good development stories. I mean, Harrison got a lot of money in the draft, but he was a high schooler in the third round in 2020, and the 2020 draft, I'm sure that we're going to end up with 72,000 oral histories of that over the course of the next decade, because it was just such a bizarre situation, right? With the world shut down and college baseball having 4 weekends and most high schools not playing. So I think in the end, the results are what helped to drive the discussion. And really, you know, listen, whether it's fair or not to people in player development, that's kind of the way it should be. Like, you need to have players that are helping your team win, whether that's for you or trading them to be able to acquire players that help you get over the top. And that's kind of where I see the Giants are right now, is that they are kind of stuck in that middle. I think they have had some really great development wins on the pitching side. We're waiting for that breakthrough on the offensive side. You know, we've seen some really well-regarded offensive prospects that have not been able to get over the hump. And I don't know that that's developmental so much as that's just the nature of baseball. It's just, the problem is that you have to wear that around your neck if you're the player development staff.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Chicken Stanley. Brian Sabian had this very core group of people he relied on. Jack Hyatt was another one. I have a sort of secret theory that one thing that happened to the Giants about 12 years ago was that Dick Tindreau got pulled more into the major league stuff when he came Sabian's AGM, and they lost that genius that he really had for going out on the scouting trail and looking at pitchers' bodies and envisioning what they were going to turn into, and that nobody recognized at the time that was just sort of an organizational resource they no longer had, that caused a bit of a dip in their pitching fortunes for several years until they've kind of come out of it recently. I don't know if that holds water, or if that's something that happens.
Well, I mean, Dick Tindreau. Yeah, Dick Tindreau, I think, would go down as one of the best evaluators of pitchers over the last 40 years. I don't think there's any secret in that. You know, he was one of the most important scouts in an organization that had a lot of great scouts, guys. I went back to Gord Goldsberry with the Phillies and the Cubs, and like legendary scout. I mean, like they Doug Mapson's like a Hall Doug of Mapson. Fame scout, right? Like, I mean, some of the guys that they had in the organization are really in Tiny Thomas, like great scout, right? Like, and I think, you know, some of that was just the evolution of, you know, as those guys got older. I mean, they were scouting in some cases, you know, going back to the 70s, you know, that they were going to retire. And I think that they probably valued Tidrow's opinion so much that they needed him on the major league side, or they needed him in a more robust role than just that very narrow focus. So I think all of that is probably fair and probably true, but I also don't think, I mean, the problem is that there's just not that many people that are Dick Tidrow, and there's only so much bandwidth that he had when he was in the organization. You could only ask him to do so much, so you had to address the needs. And certainly I think Brian Sabian is one of the more underappreciated executives of the last 20 years. He caught a pardon my French, but he caught a ton of shit from my quantitative analyst friends over the years because they didn't do things that the way that he wanted them to. But the man could evaluate talent. I mean, he was a good evaluator of talent, and he has 3 World Series rings that prove that.
You know, he played a really sneaky PR game, because I was at a Sabre event a couple years ago where a guy was talking about building one of the first artificial intelligence machines that got picked up within MLB and has propagated since then. And somebody asked him about, you know, how eager teams were to use it. And he said, well, the first team that used it was the Giants, and the first year they used it, they won their first World Series in San Francisco. So it was pretty easy for me to sell it after that. And I'm like, you would not think Brian Sabian would be one of the people originating AI, you know, codes in the game.
But I think a lot of, you know, what we've seen in individualized player development is a lot easier to sell to old school baseball people, because they can see, like, you can see how it works, right? It's not just like the easiest example is in talking about in a bullpen, right? So if a pitcher is trying to learn a slider, it used to be the pitching coach would say, how did that one feel? Because that one looked good. Do that again. Right?
Right. Right.
And now we have both radar tracking and high speed cameras that can actually show what you were doing on that, right? That allow you to see exactly what was right and what went best in such a pitch. And I think that kind of stuff, and using that in terms of artificial intelligence and trying to take that information, I think makes a little bit more sense than, here, I've handed you this paper with this very complicated algorithm and this very complicated equation that has a lot of black box to it. It's called WAR. It evaluates what everything a player does. Trust me, it's right. You know, like, that's a tougher sell.
That is. But the other thing we have now is, instead of, like, I remember this one guy threw a pitch like this, is every team and outside organizations have a massive database of pitch grip pictures. And you can, Keaton Wynn told me the story. They look at his pitch grip and they run an algorithm that says, hey, this other guy had a similar one and the splitter worked for them. So why don't we teach this guy the splitter? And lo and behold, you've got yourself a major league pitcher.
Yeah. Or like, now we're starting to spend more time on like pitchers who are more who supinate better than they can pronate. Right.
Right.
Most pitchers are like that. But like Logan Webb is a really good example of this. Right. You know, he throws this wicked two seamer, but he doesn't really pronate. He's a seam shifted wake pitcher with both his sinker and his changeup. And so what he's doing is, the way he's positioning the ball is on kind of, you know, if you imagine like your index and your middle finger, and you were to kind of position the ball more towards the outside of your middle finger when you're delivering the pitch, you're kind of cutting it, almost like cutting it to go to the arm side. And so like you're talking about this is as something that is really different than what was, hey, let's try and mess around with a whole bunch of different things and hope something sticks.
Yeah. So this brings up something I want to talk to you about. And I say this as my Zoom gives me the upgrade now message. So this will be our last topic. You know, Logan Webb comes to the majors as essentially a four seam curveball guy who had an interesting changeup. That shift to Tomb Seam, to figuring out the Seam Shifted Wake, to mastering the changeup mostly happens after he's made his major league debut. We're seeing now Kyle Harrison coming up through the minors was, this guy's got a great fastball and a fantastic slider. You get to the majors and all of a sudden that slider is not working quite as well as it did in the minors. And now, like, he's got a problem solved. So I guess a kind of final question is, how much of development ultimately is a major league thing? How much do these guys have to change who they are once they hit that level and figure out that things don't work the way they used to when they were in Kansas?
Well, I think it's a really good question, and I think unfortunately it's variable for each player, right? So, like to your point on Harrison, if you want to call it a slurve, I think that's what they categorize it at, right? The breaking ball is pretty appealing looking, right? But it hasn't gotten great results, and I wonder how much of that is that he really struggles to command the fastball glove side to right-handers, which is what most lefties do, right? It's like if you can work inside to right-handed hitters as a left-handed pitcher, you're going to have a ton of success. And it's just not consistent there. He's much more comfortable working to the arm side, which, gives a different look for the hitter, and it makes them a little bit more selective. And they don't seem in fear of the slider the way lefties do, right? Lefties still do tend to struggle with it. And I went back and watched the start Saturday, and that was the case, right? Like he was all over Corbin Carroll and Tucker Barnhart, no problem against the righties. It was a fastball that leaked out over the plate. And when it wasn't at the top of the zone, it got hit a little bit. The changeup is just kind of okay, although he throws it a lot. He's got a good fastball, though. So I think a lot of it just kind of depends on the player. And, you can do some of that in player development, but the difference between feedback and results in AAA and the big leagues is night and day. There's never been a bigger gap between AAA and the big leagues as there is right now. And it's always been the biggest gap between two levels, even though they're close together, because to be a big leaguer, it just takes a different level of consistency. Everybody in AAA could play in the big leagues. Most of them have played in the big leagues, but not all of them can stay there. And so, it's constantly getting feedback, and the feedback comes in results, right? And so, I'm sure that Kyle Harrison felt like, okay, now that once the control issues have kind of plagued him early last year, we're under control. Okay, I can play this fastball slider together. It's going to work really well. And I've got this changeup I've been working on. Well, now you're going to have to start to look at things that pair better, how the shapes work together, how you can try and we now talk about tunneling, but basically make the pitches look the same for as long as possible. And what are things you can do probably with your fastball, since it is his best pitch, to make right-handed hitters more likely to swing at that best secondary? Those are all things that are, from a fan's perspective, can be very frustrating because you're going to find inconsistent performances. But as somebody who's evaluating, it gives you something to lock in on, and you can see whether or not he's making those adjustments. And when you see little changes, you can be like, hey, this is starting to come, and it can get you excited about a guy maybe before they hit.
Well, I mean, one thing that's always had me very high on Harrison is, so I saw him when he got to Richmond, which was he was 20 then. And he had a mini version of this same sort of development story. He had completely bullied the guys in the Northwest League, but he got up to Richmond and the hitters were able to do a little better takes and a little better swings, and they had popped a bunch of home runs in his first couple of starts. But he pretty quickly made the adjustment, tightened up the slider because sometimes it's more slurvy and sometimes it's tighter, and basically made a run through the last couple months of that season. But then every level you go up from there, the adjustment is harder and longer, and sometimes takes, finding new pitches. I remember when Tim Lincecum got to the majors and took him, literally two batters to find out that curve that had made him the Pac-10 pitcher of the year didn't work at that level, and so he went and invented a changeup in like 2 weeks.
Yeah, there's only one Tim Lincecum. I mean, one of my favorite stories that Dave Dombrowski tells about Justin Verlander's debut, and he met with Verlander before his debut and said, "Listen, I know you've got a good fastball, but you're gonna have to mix pitches at this level, and you're gonna have to, use all your pitches to be able to get hitters out." And Verlander said, "Yeah, no problem." And he went out and was pumping 99 and getting hit around the field. When Dombrowski asked him about it afterwards, he's like, he's like, I know you said they could hit a fastball, but they hadn't seen my fastball. Right. and like that served Verlander very well in his career too. Right. That confidence is awesome. But I think it speaks to, you know, the challenges that come with until you face major league hitters consistently and you constantly have to make these little tweaks and adjustments, whether it's the pitch mix or pitch shape or sequencing. I mean, that's part of the game that keeps you alive. And if you're cerebral, I think you have a real chance to stick around. You also have to be able to execute.
Okay, I have just a couple of minutes, but I do want to swing back to Keaton Wynn, who's a guy who I've been saying for a year or two now doesn't quite get enough respect. So what has popped out? What's made you a Keaton Wynn fan watching his game?
Well, it's kind of like one, he's from Iowa, so I'm partial to anybody from Iowa because that's my family's homeland, and I you know, went to school there. So that's the first thing with Keaton Wynn. I think the other is that there are a lot of similarities in his mix to what Logan Webb does, and I think that splitter in particular is a really good pitch for him. I'm just excited by the fact that it's a combination of stuff and he's starting to develop a feel for pitching. And I think every time you see him go out, you see him get a little bit better, a little bit smarter, hit that metal Rolodex, gets a little thicker in what he's learning. So it's a combination of stuff and pitchability, which is what you dream about. And I think he's got a chance to be a pretty solid middle of the rotation type starter if he keeps on this path.
Okay, well, so I can end the show by getting you excited in Hayden Birdsong, who is another Iowa guy who's not that far away. Big arm, love our Hayden. Mike, I can't say enough that you took some time to come talk a little Giants baseball with me. I know we see you everywhere. Is there anywhere in particular I need to look for you in the coming week?
I mean, every day on MLB Network Radio at 10 a.m. Eastern, we've got a Power Alley with me and Jim Duquette, the former Orioles and Mets GM. And then this week in college baseball, usually on Thursdays on SiriusXM College with the great Michael Patrick Rooney, former ASU assistant and Notre Dame player. And a lot of college baseball games. If there's an ACC game on, there's a chance that I'm doing it. So
it's all terrific. And I'm glad you shouted out Power Alley because I really love Jim Duquette. So. Work on there. I like the pairing of you guys on that show.
He's okay. He's all right.
Yes, it is.
We'll keep him.
Well, thanks so much for coming on. And to my listeners, thanks so much for supporting the show. And we'll be back next week with, I think, a few player interviews coming from Richmond this week. Thanks, everyone. I'll be back soon. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer.